Well, I want you to imagine the discussion at Bethlehem Market in around 640 BC. There's Jesse and Barak having a conversation because there's a new king in Jerusalem, a guy called Josiah, who's actually only 8 years old. His father, Amon, has just been assassinated, and his grandfather, Manasseh, reigned for 55 years. And Jesse asks, well, what do you make of this new king? He hasn't got much chance, is he, with a dad and granddad like that? They were corrupt. They led us away from God's path. But then Barak is less interested in the religious stuff. And he says, yeah, but what about the economic mess? Prices keep going up. Jerusalem grabs all the wealth. What about leveling up? And there's that threat from the east. Those Assyrians, we don't want to go the same way as what happened to the northern kingdom of Israel. And Jesse says, yeah, but don't forget what the prophet Isaiah said. It's Babylon we need to worry about. What we need is a king like Hezekiah. He stood up to those Assyrians. He sent them packing. And that water tunnel he built, that were a marvel. Barak says, yeah, Hezekiah was good. But there was no one greater than Solomon. We were all one kingdom then. Just look at the land that we occupied. We were respected and feared then. We didn't have to worry about these enemy nations. And the wealth, they say, you know, they say the silver was as common as stones. And the books he wrote, and that temple, well, not like it is now. It's a national disgrace. And Jesse says, yes, I don't think we'll see the like of Solomon again. There was no greater king. And you can see why they would think like this. What we read there in 1 Kings 10 of Solomon's greatness. There was something pretty impressive about it, wasn't there? Just imagine living in his kingdom. For one thing, it was a kingdom of peace. You know, his father David had been very much a soldier, had many battles. But through all that, he defeated the enemies of Israel, and the borders of Israel were now greater than they'd ever been. And so it was a time of great stability after centuries, really, of war. And we all know war is costly. So if you don't have any war, the economy thrives. There's an economic boom. So it was a land of wealth, and it wasn't simply just doing well economically. It was overflowing in riches. This was not a country in debt. I mean, imagine, I'm sure any sort of company you work in or any institution, you're always being told to make savings, to see where you can be a bit more efficient, where, you know, make sure you monitor the budget. Well, imagine being in a place where people say, oh, it doesn't matter how much money you spend. It doesn't matter about the budgets, you know, there's just loads and loads of stuff there, so you just don't need to worry. That's more what Israel was like. And yes, I'm sure it wasn't all equally shared, but surely it's better to be in a country where that wealth is at least potentially present for everyone. There's some hope of help than just being in a country where there is just no wealth, even if people wanted to spread it out. You know, that all sounds rather attractive, doesn't it, in the midst of a cost of living crisis. And we're told here earlier in Kings, you know, the people of Judah and Israel were numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, they were happy. This was a great place. And the Queen of Sheba says, in what we read in verse 8, you know, how happy your men must be, how happy your officials who continually to stand before you and hear your wisdom. This was a place where wisdom was made sort of visible in Solomon's rule. And when we talk about wisdom, don't think of sort of a boffin, something theoretical. Think more of almost Alan Sugar. Think of a businessman almost. It's someone who's got that sort of wisdom, knows how to do deals, how to make money, how to be a diplomat, build alliances. If you like, how to sort of succeed in life. It's more that sort of idea as to what wisdom is. In a sense, how to be happy and successful. And there was also wisdom in justice. Solomon was known for his for his justice. You could be confident of a fair hearing when things went wrong. And he also had wisdom in understanding the natural world. Read what it says here. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He described plant life, from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also taught about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. You see, Solomon was an environmentalist long before that was fashionable. He understood the natural world. And there was the temple. And in a way, this was his most lasting contribution. This temple that he built stood for nearly 400 years. It was a wonder of the ancient world. It was dripping with grandeur, with gold. And it was a center of national life. You would travel to it 3 times a year in these annual festivals. Places it would be overflowing with food. And it was something, therefore, so important for their national identity. And you almost get a sense of this when you fast forward centuries later, when you have King Herod, the king that was there when Jesus was born. He began to build a temple that he was trying to make as impressive as Solomon's. This king was trying to, like, shore up his political position. So he was trying to sort of say, well, look, I'm like Solomon. Look at the temple I'm going to build. And it was Solomon. Herod's temple was also pretty impressive, but not quite on the scale of Solomon's. And just think of the reputation that Solomon had. The way that this queen would travel 1,000 miles to meet him. Solomon was something of a celebrity, the sort of leader that everyone wants to be photographed with. How would you feel as an Israelite? Well, you would feel proud, wouldn't you? You certainly wouldn't want to be part of a nation that people despised or mocked. Well, consider your life this morning. Think of the things that matter to you, that matter to the people around us. Maybe it's the cost of living crisis. Maybe it's searching for justice. Maybe it's knowing a bit more long-term security, being able to feel like you belong. Maybe it's care for the environment. Well, if those are your sort of concerns, Solomon is the leader you want, isn't he? I mean, if you're not convinced, think of the opposite. You don't want a leader that brings war, that brings poverty, that is stupid, that trashes the planet, that is unjust, and that is despised so that no one wants anything to do with him. Solomon's the opposite of all of that. So Solomon is seriously impressive. But the message this morning is that he is pathetic compared to the leader that you could actually have today. Hear these words of Jesus. The queen of the south will rise at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom. And now one greater than Solomon is here. Those were words spoken by Jesus. Has Jesus lost the plot? Greater than Solomon? Jesus of Nazareth from that despised town? This guy with this ragbag of rather unimpressive disciples, and certainly with no money. Do you hear how ridiculous Jesus' claim is? Almost how offensive it is. You know, Solomon was a national hero. You know, it'd be like sort of me saying I was a greater war leader than Churchill or something. You know, people would be pretty offended, wouldn't they? But that is Jesus' claim here. He is greater than the greatest king, Solomon. How on earth can that make sense? Well, in the first place, it makes sense if we understand the whole picture of Solomon. Because the Bible is very honest It doesn't glamorize its heroes, even its greatest king. Solomon's failings are laid bare here as well. And in fact, you get this even in chapter 10. All this stuff about the wealth, it is very impressive, but there's a sort of sense of it being a little bit over the top, isn't it? You know, gold shields. I can tell you as a metallurgist, that doesn't have a lot of military value. You don't need gold in shields. And do you really need a throne with 12 lions covered in, well, made of ivory and covered in gold? I mean, it seems a bit like sort of wealth for it, almost don't know what to do with the money, wealth for its own sake to project power. And was indeed some of this luxury at the expense of the people? Well, the answer to that is yes. If you read on to chapter 12, you discover that actually people had found his rule in the end rather oppressive, and they rebel against that with his son. And what about those 700 wives and 300 concubines? Maybe even if you almost secretly rather admire Solomon's lavishness, isn't it rather OTT? And of course, it's not very good from the woman's point of view. They had become ornaments of power, rather like those gold lions. And in fact, Solomon, for all his privilege, ended up being the exact opposite of the sort of king that God said he wanted. It's very striking when you look back in Deuteronomy, the sort of king that God describes that he wants. Solomon does the exact opposite of all of this in the end. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself. Well, we read about horses, didn't we? Or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. He gets horses from Egypt. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives. Well, he certainly didn't stick to that. Or his heart will be led astray. Oh, look what happened to Solomon. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. Couldn't be starker, could it? And bizarrely, even his wisdom that he was famed for, he ends up arming his enemies. At the end of chapter 10, he's giving out weaponry, in effect, to people that will be using it against the nation in years to come. That isn't wisdom. And it's a kingdom that doesn't last. Solomon dies, and in fact, it's in the very next generation with his son, the kingdom divides into this southern kingdom of Judah, the northern kingdom of Israel. It's a very sobering message. Even such a great leader as Solomon tells us that every leader will let you down. I wonder how you would finish the sentence. The leader we need is, I'm not necessarily asking for a name, but even just a sort of type of leader. You know, I wonder how you would answer that. You know, what's the sort of leader we need? Well, I can assure you, however you answer that, however much they share your ideals, they will let you down. Probably most likely what you're thinking is, the leader we need is someone who is basically like myself. You know, actually, often people say, well, I'm not following anyone. I don't have any ideology. I don't believe in anything. I know what's right. I'll do what's right for me. In other words, I'm Solomon. Well, I can guarantee this, that you will let yourself down in the end. In Solomon, we see a picture of all of us. In some ways, we see sort of humanity at its best. Solomon, like the first man, Adam. See, Adam ruled over the world with wisdom. He understood the natural world, didn't he? He named the animals. Solomon is being a bit like that here. That land of Eden, a place with gold. But those capabilities that Adam had and that Solomon had and that we have were all given by God. Even the Queen of Sheba recognized this. She recognized it was in verse 9, it was God who had placed him on this throne. It was God who had given him all these gifts. He had given him this position. And it's the same with each one of us. All the good stuff in you, all the capabilities, the gifts, the abilities you have to understand things, to make money, to do whatever you do in your life, all of those capabilities come from God. The problem is, as it was for Solomon, for Adam, and for ourselves, is that we have perverted those gifts God has given. Solomon ended up perverting that wisdom that he had been given. And you can't say, well, of course, the reason Solomon went wrong was because of sort of his background. You know, he never had a chance. You can't say he had any lack of knowledge or education, or you know, it was the wrong sort of environment he was brought up in. He had no lack of opportunity. He had everything at his disposal. That wasn't the problem with Solomon. We can't blame our circumstances. We're told very simply what the problem with Solomon was in chapter 11, verse 4. His heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God. His heart, the core of his being, what he really wanted, if you like, was not devoted to God. And it's the same in each of us. It's something very deep in us. Whatever we're like on the outside, on the inside, we have this natural inclination to turn away from God, to turn away from his rule, turn away from his commands, and to trust ourselves. And I think it's that truth that explains the jarring contrast we find in humanity, and if we're honest, in ourselves. We are capable of great things, great achievements. You know, we can travel to the moon. We can do great good, and as we do that, we reflect God. And yet, at the same time, with those same capabilities, we are capable of great evil, great destruction, even self-destruction. Have you ever had to say to yourself, why did I do that? How could I have been so stupid? We have that twin nature in us, don't we? Which means that whatever leader you pick, and yes, some will be better than others, they will all let you down. Thousands of years of history teach us that. I'm always astonished how people sort of think, you know, the next leader will be different. We've got thousands of years of history that teach us that's not the case. Why should it be any different in the future? So we are rather stuck, aren't we, if that's the case? Every leader will let you down. Which leader do you want? I've entitled this. Every leader will let you down. We're stuck, aren't we? Well, let's come back to what Jesus said, because he said he's greater than Solomon. Jesus is different. And understand that Jesus' greatness is not just a bigger version of Solomon. It's not Solomon without some defects. He's someone in a totally different category. In fact, he couldn't almost be more different to Solomon. You know, for one thing, he'd had no human position of power. He had no political authority, no privileged upbringing. He was an outcast. He was despised by the elites. He was eventually executed. He didn't have foreign queens coming to visit him. But the people that did come to him were the marginalized, the despised, the outcasts. Unclean people with leprosy. There was a Gentile Canaanite woman who once came to Jesus begging for help. You see, Solomon went to lots of women and used them. Prostitutes came to Jesus for help. There's quite a contrast. In fact, it's very striking how many encounters with women we find in the Gospels. Culturally quite strange. And yet Jesus treats them with respect as individuals with their own voice. And all long before any Me Too movement. And when it comes to riches, the contrast with Solomon couldn't be greater. Jesus relied on the support of his friends. And all he seemed to own by the end of his life were the clothes that he wore. And yet, he was richer than Solomon. He was so rich that he could afford to give it all away. See, Solomon's riches came from inheritance, largely. Came from trade, from politics, and indeed, ultimately, from God. But Jesus is rich because he is God. That's the only way of making any sense of his claims. Everything belongs to himself. He is rich in himself. It's not that he's been given something that he could then lose, but rather he gave up what belonged to him for the sake of others. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, far richer than Solomon, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you, through his poverty, might become rich. That's the sort of leader you want. And he was wiser than Solomon. He was the one who gave Solomon his wisdom. As a 12-year-old, people were astonished at Jesus' understanding. He'd not been taught by any great scholars. He had that understanding in himself. This is who he was. Later in life, people kept trying to trap him in his words. Each time, the tables are turned on his accusers. And we're still, in some ways, still trying to understand what some of his answers mean. You know, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God's what is God's. I still don't think we quite got to the bottom of what he was really saying there. That there's a real depth to Jesus' teaching of the parables. We think of them as simple stories. Well, simple sort of. But they're the simplicity of a genius. A friend of mine is writing a book at the moment on Jesus' parables, showing the sort of genius of them in the way that they are, they reflect so many Old Testament narratives, all at multiple levels, with an incredible sort of economy and simplicity. Something that is the mark of genius. He was wiser than Solomon. And the difference is stark when it comes to creation as well. You see, Solomon describes creation. Jesus controls it. He stills a raging storm. Jesus is the creator. He has this position of absolute power. He heals those with illness, with disability, with a word, with a touch. Not sort of showing off, oh, look how much power I've got, but using that authority that he has in himself to help people, to rescue people, often the most marginalized. And what of Solomon's most lasting achievement? The temple. Well, that was long destroyed, wasn't it, by Jesus' day? Herod was building that temple to try and replace it. Look what is said here. The Jews demanded of him, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." The Jews replied, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple." That's the temple that Herod was building. "And you're going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he'd spoken of was his body. You see, Solomon made a house for God. Jesus is God with us. Jesus is the temple. All that God is compacted into this single human being, Jesus Christ. As we were saying before, even as a baby, he was controlling the universe. I always love the way C.S. Lewis puts this, that there was more inside the stable where Jesus lay than the entire universe outside. Why? Because the maker of the universe, the one who was sustaining the universe, even at that time, lay inside. Jesus really is greater than Solomon. So you can imagine how people would respond. It's Jesus, yeah, greater than Solomon. Everyone would be saying, well, look, here's the leader we need. Here's the leader we want. That's surely what would happen. except it wasn't. People felt threatened by Jesus, undermined by him. Look at the context of that claim that Jesus makes about being greater than Solomon. Notice, the same as what we saw in that reading from John, looking for a sign, you know, who do you think you are? Prove to us you're this special person. Some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law said to him, "Teacher, we want to see a miraculous sign from you." He answered, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man," that's Jesus, "will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and now one greater than Jonah is here." And it's after that he goes on to speak of Solomon. They're saying, "What makes you special, Jesus?" And he mentions the same sign as we saw in John. It's this idea of being killed on a cross and rising again after 3 days. 3 days in the heart of the earth, that's talking about his burial. Why was Jesus killed? Well, it was precisely because they didn't want him as their leader. They didn't want his rule. They wanted to keep that power, as they thought they had, for themselves. And yet Jesus says their very rejection of him is the greatest evidence of who he really is. The cross, if you like, is his throne. But there's no gold on this throne. There's no ivory. The cross shows his true identity and why he is in a totally different category to Solomon. The Queen of Sheba saw Solomon making sacrifices in the temple, sacrifices for sin. Well, Jesus does better than that. Jesus, who is the temple, is also the sacrifice for sin. He gives his life so that we can be forgiven. The answer to that problem of our hearts that are turned away from God, of our rejection of him and his rule. You see, Solomon, like all of us, was a sinner. He just adds to the problems of the world. Ultimately, that's what we all do. We just add to the problems of the world. Jesus is a savior. He does something about it. And his rule is not self-serving. It's not oppressive. It's sacrificial. It's for the good of others. It's liberating. And Jesus has a kingdom. It's where we're going to finish. In this verse we were looking at, the way it's perhaps not translated in the best way in the version we were using here, because when it says the Queen of the South, that's the Queen of Sheba, when she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom, and now what it really says is something greater than Solomon is here, which seems a bit strange, you know, comparing to another person, but something greater than Solomon is here. What's this saying? It's saying that Jesus is doing something. He's building something that affects us today. You see, it's very easy to look at all this and think this is all just stuff in the past. But please don't misunderstand me. It is not that Jesus was this great person in the past that we can sort of admire, look back to, a bit like, you know, I don't know, eulogizing about someone in a funeral. We're saying he has present relevance. He is alive. He is king today of the whole universe. He is building a kingdom where his rule is welcomed and embraced by all who follow him. He is building a kingdom of righteousness, justice, equality, freedom, purpose, and peace. All of those things that we long for. You know, if a leader came along and that was their manifesto, you would say, yeah, we'll sign up to that. Well, understand this. You can't have any of those things independent of God. Those things that we long for are actually only found in Jesus. Everything else that everyone offers is a sort of fake imitation of it. So when we reject Jesus, we are actually rejecting the very things we are searching for. Self-destructive. This message about Jesus is going out into the world. His kingdom is growing. You see, he doesn't wait for the world to come to him like the Queen of Sheba coming to Solomon. No, no, this message goes out into the world. People from all nations are in his kingdom. But understand this. His kingdom is a kingdom that will involve suffering. Following Jesus now will involve taking the path that he took. It's not going to be a kingdom like Solomon's riches. It's going to be a kingdom better than that. Because the riches of Jesus' kingdom are not pathetic things like gold. I mean, who needs gold? The riches of Jesus' kingdom are Jesus himself. So don't follow Jesus to be rich. Rather use whatever you have, whatever God has given you, in his service and looking to his return. You see, Jesus is coming back. He refers in those passages to the judgment. And that is a day of justice that is far greater than any justice that Solomon brought. And it's a judgment that is determined by what we do with Jesus. That's what Jesus was saying to the people. He's saying, I'm here amongst you. I am telling you the truth. But if you don't respond to that, you will be judged more severely than even these, what would be seen as wicked nations from the past. You have this choice to bow to his rule or to resist it. And as he brings that final judgment, he ushers in this eternal, everlasting kingdom, a kingdom of true peace, of true rest. It's an everlasting kingdom. Solomon's kingdom ended very quickly. So which leader do you want to follow? We're on a journey. The Queen of Sheba traveled 1,000 miles to listen to Solomon. She had the humility to realize she had something to learn. But at the end, she went back home. I don't think anyone here has traveled 1,000 miles to be here today. But you have heard, not my words in the end, Jesus' words, his call. Will you just go back home and carry on as before? Like those crowds that listened to Jesus himself? Or will you stay with Jesus? Will you join his sort of retinue, if you like, his crowd of followers? Will you trust your life to him? Turn away from the life you've been living and instead turn to have a life of following him and being part of his kingdom. We all have this choice. What leader do we want? Jesus is greater than Solomon.